Good morning. You're listening to Life Downstream, a show that asks Astoria residents to talk about some of the things life has taught them. I'm Andrew Morgan, a high school teacher.
And I'm Keegan Rasko, a high school student.
Join us as we ask guests to reflect on some of the lessons they've learned outside the classroom. On today's show, we're going to talk with Jeff Daly, a longtime Astoria resident who wears many, many hats. Jeff is a photographer, a local historian, a mental health advocate, a traveler, videographer, among other things. And on today's show, he's going to walk us through some of the things that he's learned over decades spent in both Astoria and San Francisco. Jeff, can we start today by you telling us a little bit about what that journey was like, that leaving town, moving to the big city, what kind of pulled you away?
Well, the first thing you have to do is when you talk about people that lived in Astoria, you have to say what class they're from. Because that's the reference we use. I'm a class of 69.
Okay.
Yeah, we were very proud of that number, and we were also part of the transfer of the school system going from 3-year to 4-year and back and forth. So That was a big year. Oh, yeah, the class of 69. Go, guys. We got our 50th class reunion coming up this year.
Wow, 50th. Okay.
Yeah. So 50 years ago, I was here in Astoria, but I left when I was 27.
Okay.
Moved to Portland for a couple of years and then ended up in San Francisco area for 30 years.
What was Astoria like when you left?
Oh, it was very affordable living then. I was living in the Elliott Hotel before I moved out. It was, I think it was $131 a week. I had to provide my own mattress. It was just a bed spring and a sink and a dresser. I was out of work, not knowing what I was going to do with my life. And it was about 2:00 in the morning. I was looking out the window, watching the people leaving the Schooner Tavern. And I thought, it's time to move on. And I literally packed my car that evening.
Wow.
And at 4:30 in the morning, I was driving to Portland. No idea what I was going to do, where I was going to go, where I was going to sleep that night. But I decided I needed to get out of Astoria. It was a tough town.
Wow.
It was a rough, tough time at that time. There was very few employment opportunities. The plywood mill had shut down. Canneries were closing down. For what used to be for us kids in the 60s there, we thought we were all taken care of when we got out of school. In fact, we thought we didn't have to spend much time in school because we were guaranteed a nice little job when we got out.
Hmm.
Well, over a period of short time, all those jobs went away.
Mm-hmm. So when you went to Portland, what did you have in mind that you would be doing for work out there?
I had no idea what I was going to do. I had been teaching here in Astoria at Clatsop College for 2 years, and it was time to move on. I had gotten divorced, and life was changing. When I went to Portland, I really didn't know what I was going to do. But when I had been in Portland during my college years, I had done an internship at Channel 2 up there. And so I went to Channel 2 when I went to Portland, and I said, you guys got any kind of work? And after I went there for a couple of weeks, they finally said, well, we do have some work. We have a switchboard operator position. When they want to go on lunch or dinner, we have nobody to cover it. So would you be willing to work a 40-hour, 7-day week? You would do breakfast, lunch, and dinner, fill in. I'd say, well, what do I do the rest of the time? Well, it's kind of a split shift. So that was my week, is I would work from 7 till 8 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Then I'd go home or do something. Then I'd come back from noon to 1. Then I'd go back from 6 till 8.
Okay. So
that's how I did that 7 days a week.
Wow.
So it was kind of an oddball schedule.
Damn. Did you do that for a couple years before moving south to San Francisco? Or
no, I was a switchboard operator doing that kind of schedule for about 2 months until a Saturday night. Somebody came out and said, close down the switchboard. Do you know how to shoot film? And I said, not really. And they said, well, we need some film shot of 5 basketball games tonight. So they said, shut the switchboard down. They handed me a camera. I went into the bathroom with a photographer friend of mine. I said, how does this work? He gave me a quick lesson, and I proceeded to go out and shoot 5 high school basketball games, rush it back for the 11 o'clock news. I edited it. It went on the air with Dick Carr announcing it, and my film splice promptly broke, and my first story never made the air. But I stuck with it, and I ended up getting a part-time job there. And then I got a summer replacement job, and then I got an evening job, and then I got a job. I was there for 2 years before I went to San Francisco.
Do you feel like that is something that has continued to kind of pop up in your life, this idea of, if you're willing to do this, you often end up finding yourself in the right place? You know, do you feel like those things go together?
No, I think that's part of our family values that we learned from our family, from our parents. Living in a small town like this, you were taught to have work ethic. You were taught to work hard, to sometimes not ask questions, just say, yes, I will. I call it sort of the grandfather thing, where there was somebody always there willing to take you under their wing and teach you how to do something. But more importantly, just say, stick your neck out, go for it. If you think you want that, go for it. Don't say no, just go for it and give it a try.
What was it like when you got to San Francisco?
Well, I went to San Francisco working once again as a freelancer, part-time, without any commitment of a job. But I was giving myself a little truck that said News Center 4 on it, and I went out trying to figure out how to drive in a big city, because I'd only been driving in an Astoria in Portland before. My gosh. I ran into some pretty big Astoria events, and this particular one was one that welcomed me for about my second week in San Francisco. So what that means is that I was the cameraman that shot this footage of Feinstein announcing that there was an assassination at the City Hall. And in fact, my footage was used for the opening of the Milk movie that starred Sean Penn.
Oh, wow.
That moment where she announces that. That was an amazing moment. Once again, I'm just this kid from the class of 69. We had the Moscone milk murders. We had Guyana going on.
What was the energy like in the city, you know, while this was happening? I mean, I imagine.
Oh, it was incredibly depressing. It affected the entire city for years. I know I was affected by it. With that and all the other things were going on at that time with the Guyana stuff, I lost friends in Guyana that went down there. Greg Robinson, he was shot and killed. Bob Brown from NBC was shot. He survived. When they went to Jonestown. So yeah, it was a heavy, heavy thing, which once again, I'm not sure as this little kid was ready for all this. There I am. I'm recently divorced, going down there, watching murder and mayhem literally before my eyes, and watching my footage on the NBC Nightly News going, what just happened here?
Did you feel like, you know, you were able to link up with other people down there and kind of commiserate about this? Were you spending that first kind of chapter of your life in San Francisco alone and trying to process this yourself, or
No, it bonded us. In fact, it was just the anniversary of the assassinations here just recently, and the reporters and the cameramen that were there at the time, we all rebonded this, you know, via the internet and started resharing our stories and actually telling each other stories that we had forgotten about that happened on that. Everybody was sort of in the same boat. We almost needed some psychiatric help. I mean, it was that kind of heavy, heavy emotions that laid upon everybody.
What ultimately, if you can kind of point to a moment where you felt like things started to turn, you know, when did that cloud kind of start to lift for you when you were down there?
Well, probably went back to some of the old advice my parents used to give to me. Get over it. as a kid, we'd go up and go, oh, I hurt myself. I hurt my feet. Get over it. Get over it. Get over it. I think that is, I mean, seriously, that is part of the deal. Especially when you're working in the news business, there really isn't time for emotion because you're there to do a job. I won't even tell you about some of the things I've seen and had to do that are not normal, but you just have to say it's not happening before my eyes, and you got to get it on film. You got to provide it to the station that's looking for it.
I know you talked a little bit about kind of getting these really key shots at the key moment and finding yourself just in the right place at the right time. Could you talk a little bit about one or two of these moments that opened up a whole bunch of other doors for you in the future? Were there any shots you can kind of point back to and say that led to this, 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 and this?
I actually got a phone call from a CBS producer, and he said, can you go to a 49ers game? And all I need you to do is shoot footage of one guy, and that's it. And I said, okay, fine. Call the news desk and tell them. And I says, no, I don't want to hire the news desk. That costs too much money. Can I just give you $100 and you'll go do it? And I'm saying, no, that we can't do that. We're union. Well, all right, I'll do it for you. I have no idea who this guy is. So I go to shoot this footage. I send it to him. A couple months later, I get a call from him. Says, hey, do you have one of those crane things? And I said, yeah. And he goes, can you bring that to Augusta and do some crane shots for me? And I said, what's in Augusta? And he goes, it's the Augusta Golf Course, fool. And I said, well, I guess if you want me to come down there, okay. Well, is this through the desk or you? And he goes, no, we'll hire you for this one. So I flew to Augusta, the Augusta Masters Tournament. And I did the shot going down Magnolia Lane, which had never been done before, Well, little did I know that that $100 day that I worked for it ended up for, I went to 14 masters.
Wow.
Filmed in 14 masters. I had access that nobody else in the world has had or ever has had since. We shot the Tiger Woods famous 16th shot that won an Emmy for us and CBS. I did the Olympics for CBS, won an Emmy with that. So yeah, it all started with a $100 day.
Wow. When you're filming, do you ever have these moments where you realize that's it? I just got it. And when you have those moments, what separates those from just probably the 95% of the other moments where you're videotaping? I mean, how do you know when I just got that Tiger Woods shot? That's the one. Do you ever have that feeling?
When I drove into the camp, that's when I was wondering if I had that shot. The day that happened, that famous shot, that day the CBS said, we are now going to start using HD cameras. We want you to use ours. And they handed me a camera I had never used in my life. And it was highly, highly technical. It was not the camera like I had been using where you put it on your shoulder and you shoot. So I am out there now following Tiger Woods around on this Masters Day, final tournament day, with a camera I don't know how to really use. The thing is black and white. I'm not seeing the top of their heads. There's this thing flipping on the right. There's no time to fix it. You're shooting a golf tournament. So that moment when that Nike ball hung and hung and hung, I shot. I'm wondering, when do I go to Tiger's face? Is it going to drop? I don't know. When should I zoom in or out? When should I? Well, I ended up getting it, but I didn't know that I got it. And it wasn't until the tournament was over and I drove back to the CBS camp, and there was a line of producers standing there saying, did you get it? Did you get it? And I said, I don't know. And they're looking at me saying, what do you mean you don't know? Give us the tape. And I handed them the tape. They ran in the truck. And I'm sitting there going, okay. And I hear this yelping and yelling and yelling. They come running out. They're running down the street. And I said, where are you going? They said, you just made $1 million. I said, excuse me? And they said, Phil Knight just called and says he wants that footage. They're going to run a commercial the next day on all of the morning shows, and he paid $1 million for it.
Wow.
I said, I can't wait to get my check. And they said, you don't even get a hat out of this. You're already on salary. But yeah, but that was a moment where I didn't know I had it until they came out dancing. So That's the way sometimes that business works, is you sometimes shoot, waiting for it to happen.
Could you talk a little bit about what that process was like to come back to town? I'm really curious, you know, what made you move back? What were some of those changes that you noticed when you decided to kind of come on back?
Well, I had retired in San Francisco after 30 years. I had to get out of the business. My hip was gone, so I wasn't able to do what I used to physically do. And it wasn't shortly after retiring there that the heat, the cost, and the people started getting up there to a 95%. And I said, I think I've had my time in California. And so we moved back to California. And in my opinion, right here in Astoria, from California, yeah. We actually had a house in Seaside. We moved there first, but then came to Astoria. But for me, this was one of those great opportunities to come back home. How many songs have been written, right, about going home or not going home? And some people will say, I could never go there. For me, this was ideal. I can't think of anywhere else I'd want to be or could be.
What about it pulled you back? You know, where was the allure? I mentioned earlier when we were talking
people.
That...
The people.
The people.
Yeah. Yeah. I lived in Larkspur, which is just north of San Francisco, for 10 years. And there was only two times in that entire 10 years in this town of 25,000 that I ever walked through downtown that I ran into somebody I knew.
Really?
Two times in 10 years. You can't do that
in
Astoria.
Crazy. Yeah.
You can't get down the street without talking to people. In fact, you always have to come late because you're always talking. I missed that. I missed friendships. I missed education. I missed the knowledge and the history that's here. I missed the water. Yeah. And I do miss the weather here. People complain about, where else you want to be? You want to be in the Midwest or down? No, I want to be right here. It's perfect.
Did you notice a big shift in just the kind of energy of the town in terms of, you know, what businesses were here? And you're interested in the arts and talk a little bit about that.
Well, Astoria's in this wonderful growth period. Some are saying growing a little too fast, but no, some of the old folks have passed on. Some of the old habits have changed. There's some new blood coming to town, and yeah, look at our downtown. It's vibrant. We got good people that are running around wanting to do things. There's people moving here. There are so many secret people in this town that you meet somebody yeah. and you start talking a little more about them. You're going, oh my gosh, do you know who that guy is over there?
Yeah.
He did da da da, and he's worth so much. Da da ba ba boom. That's what Astoria does, right? It brings these people here just because of the magic of this wonderful town. I get out there every once in a while on the river and I look back at Astoria and I blink my eyes twice, go, am I back in San Francisco? Because when you get up on the water yeah. looking back at this town with the Victorians and the colors and the tree, it's magnificent. No wonder they love doing movies here.
Jeff, you had said that you kind of feel like this town is this canvas. You know, this town, when you came back, it felt like this place that inspired your creativity. What are some of the different endeavors and things you've been working on since you've come back that have been an outlet for that creativity?
Well, that's a good question. It is an open canvas. It's you can do whatever you want here, and it's encouraged to do it. It's always been my goal. My wife's goal was that same way, is that we've taken everything that we've learned in our business, in our careers, in our experience, we want to give it back. And that's the thing I've always loved doing, is giving it back, trying to teach people what you've learned. It's free to them, and it's going to help somebody out. So I've just loved getting into projects. I brought the old clown car back and got that restored, got it back on the road. My dad was one of the founders of the clowns, so we've done that to support the Astoria Clowns, all they did for the community. We've done the Luminard Festival we did last year, the projected on the building. We're doing the underground tours now of Astoria. That's has become hugely popular. I'm bringing people in that are the tour guides. They're loving the history. They're teaching the history. It's just this great way to, once again, give back to the community, get something else going that's teaching people and getting people involved.
So cool.
Yeah, I found that we were talking about Sporticity and like thinking outside the box, thinking creatively, and I can say that there's nothing that inspires somebody more when you see a giant clown car or a train drive through the streets of Astoria in a tiny little 10,000 person town. So I think that's just being out there and doing that helps a lot of people grow beyond what they thought, or at least it helps me sometimes.
Well, that's good. And that's what you wanted to do. It's and I have the train that I drive around, and I can't tell you how many times I'll pull up and kids in the age of around 4 to 6 are just enthralled with it. Mm-hmm. And I just automatically just pull over and say, get your kids on board. Let's give them a little ride. And parents love it. But it's in a little town like this. You didn't expect that to happen, but that's just kind of the fun unexpected, which just puts a smile on somebody's face, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be, like, the fact that that's allowed to happen in Astoria is going to be one of the biggest economic drivers I could possibly think of. Like, this town grows because people do things that aren't normal.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's great.
Can we talk a little bit about, you mentioned your father earlier and Astoria Clowns, and when I think of Astoria Clowns, I think of this story about, the way that your father used Astoria Clowns. Could you talk a little bit about that? You know, what doors did that open up for him, and where did he kind of take that?
Well, now are you talking in regards to the Molly story?
To the Molly story, to just kind of getting out in the community. Could you talk a little bit about Astoria Clowns, and then we can
Well, the Astoria Clowns were formed in 1955, and their goal was to get that bridge built out there. They were businessmen from town, and they said, if we have a bridge here, Highway 101 will be finished, and we'll bring people from Washington to shop here. And they said, it's a good idea. So in 69, the bridge was approved, and the bridge was built, which our past mayor, Willis Van Dusen, says that's the bridge that a bunch of clowns built. So they get accredited that. They actually do, for being instrumental in really getting that process done. After they did that, I had a sister that was sent away to Salem to an institution. The doctors deemed her as being severely medically retarded, and she was sent to the institution.
How old was she when?
She was three years old.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was 6 years old when she went down there. Well, my dad wanted to go down there and still visit her, even though she was there, and he would go down. But unfortunately, the staff would say, you can't come back anymore, because whenever you leave, she gets very emotional, and she'll have these horrible withdrawals. Well, yes, she's seeing her father. She was not that mentally retarded that she had some tie to him. So he was not allowed to go back to see his daughter anymore. After my dad was told he could not go to Fairview anymore to visit his daughter, he came up with an idea, and the clowns joined in with him. They actually, we found it written out in the bylaws that Jack Daly, and they actually mistakenly written, had a son that was in the Salem Hospital, so we will go and visit. So what they would do is if they were in Salem or somewhere else, they would then divert over to the hospital. This clown's all still dressed up. They would go over and visit the hospital, go through some of the different places, but they'd always visit my daughter, or my sister rather, and they had no idea that this was a daughter-father joining up there.
Amazing.
But my dad would always find Molly and spend the most time with her.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was quite an amazing thing what the clowns did for the people in Salem.
Wow. Could you talk a little bit more about just this journey that your family had to kind of go through with Molly and this experience of having her over in Salem? Could you tell us a little bit more about that story?
Well, it was a tough time for my parents. My sister was sent away. People in Astoria knew my sister, but
and at the time, this was how a lot of families in the U.S., you know, kind of intervened or tried to...
It seemed like a great idea.
Yeah.
A place where everybody that was the same could go to. It was a place where they could all be taken care of under one roof. The concept seemed good. The federal government encouraged it. Well, it turned out later that institutional living was horrific and everything about it was wrong. It was shut down eventually. But at that time, that's what was acceptable. I never saw Molly. We never really talked about her during my entire youth. It wasn't until after my father's death that we discovered in his wallet, it said Molly and a phone number. And my wife at that time, Cindy, made some phone calls. And literally the next day, she was able to track Molly down.
Could you talk a little bit about what that moment was like when you, I mean, can you picture this single scrap of paper in your father's wallet? I mean, what was going through your mind when you saw this? Was it, were you thinking there's no way this could be what I think it is? Or,
well, it was, you know, I had known about Molly. I mean, and Cindy and I had obviously had talked about Molly because she knew Molly is when she was growing up here also. Mm. So when we saw this piece of paper, it had this kind of aura, but it looked like it was glowing. We're going, well, Molly, why is he still carrying? Is she still around? Where is she? I wonder what. And it was when we found out, we called some people, and because somebody went over their limit of what they should do and said, well, we do have a Molly Daly here. You can't do that today in HIPAA laws.
Wow.
You're not allowed to even say who your people are, but somebody actually said, we have a Molly Daly here. So that was this unbelievable magical moment where we wow. jumped in a car and we drove to Hillsboro to go see my sister who I hadn't seen in almost 50 years.
What was that day like? What was that moment like? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh my gosh. Well, it was, we actually had camera there, because we were doing a documentary on Molly, this whole finding process, and it was filmed. My knees were shaking. I was sweating bullets. I was so nervous. It was so magical because she actually recognized me.
Wow.
She put her hands out and gave a sound, and there was no doubt about it that she saw something in there.
From the day you saw the slip of paper in your father's wallet to that day, how much time were we talking about?
Oh, it wasn't that long of a period because,
really?
When we discovered that, we had to go through some state process to be able to get access and prove who we were, et cetera, et cetera. You just can't go into mm-hmm. group homes, mm-hmm. which is where she was living in Hillsboro. But it was a short period of time. Yeah, wow. It was remarkable.
And so since that day until now, you have been able to kind of forge this relationship and rekindle this relationship. What's that been like?
Well, we did. It was basically when Molly was sent away, it was 3 days before her third birthday. When I rediscovered her and reunited with her, it was 2 weeks before her 50th birthday.
Wow.
And unfortunately, she passed away 2 weeks before her 60th birthday.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. The clown car actually was, I was building when we brought that back to Astoria. Part of the concept was I wanted to take the clown car for her 60th birthday and give her a ride in it, just like she did when my dad was there.
Wow.
And she died, of course, before her 60th birthday, but we ended up taking the clown car to her service, and we carried her ashes home in it.
Wow. So, Jeff, I know you're retired now. You're still really active here in town with all sorts of different creative endeavors. We talked about Underground Astoria. We talked about, you know, taking pictures. What's it like when you think back to what life was like when you were in the grind and working full time? I don't know. How does it feel now to be retired?
Oh, man. In fact, I'm hoping I can use this opportunity to say I'm looking for work. okay. I need to get a job so I can get some time off.
Okay.
I am busier now than I've ever been in my life.
Really?
I do about 14 to 16-hour days. I've just got my fingers in so many things. Being retired, some people go, I can't stand being retired. I got nothing to do. I'm going, my God, what's wrong with you? I can't. There's not enough time in the day. I'll go to sleep at 2:30 in the morning upset because I wanted to do one more project, one more video, one more whatever.
Did you feel like when you were still working, you envisioned retirement being like this? Like, are you surprised that retirement has been this way? 14-hour days, tons of projects.
That's what work was. You know, when I worked, I worked 14, 16, 18-hour days.
So your retirement is
pretty similar. Much the same. Yeah, I think my body has just learned that that's what a day is all about. when we were a TV crew, you got hired by the day, and you got hired for a lot of money, and you stayed there until the job was done. So, a 16, 18-hour day to us is just was a blink of an eye. It's like, of course we're going to do that. There's a great photograph of us in the subways of New York. We were doing a show called 48 Hours, and in that day, we used to shoot literally for 48 straight hours. And there's a shot of three camera crews and our sound men, and we're all leaning against a wall in the New York subway against each other, standing up and sleeping. And we were able to get a 2.5-minute nap there, and that was our sleep that we had gotten for the night.
Wow.
But the producer shot this amazing shot. It looked like the Three Stooges with all these bodies sleeping away.
So you feel like that's pretty representative for just how your working life was.
That's what it was.
There were lots of moments like that.
It was, and never knowing what was going to happen next.
Hmm.
I've been in riots and fires and floods and everything, being shot at. You don't know where the next minute's going to come, but you know, you better be ready for it because it might be fun or it might be a little crazy.
I imagine with all these projects you're involved with now, you know, your retirement still has that quality to it, right?
Like, it does.
Next week, who knows what is going to come next week?
I got so many projects already planned for next week and some meetings set up, and I've got another thing I'm planning with the underground tour, and then I've got to get the train over, and I got to get the clown car redone. Well, that's right, my rad rod I got to do in the transmission, and then the woody wagon, and this, and I'm doing.
If we were to run into you 5 years from now, what will you be working on? What do you have any kind of like projects? Well, I don't know if you want to talk about them and reveal them, but like, are there any projects right now where you're like, this is going to take me a couple of years to put into place, but I have a vision for this?
No, if it takes like a couple of years, I won't do it.
Really?
I have to have it done by next week.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not the way I work.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for talking with us today. If anybody has any interest in going on one of these Underground Astoria tours or just reaching out and contacting Jeff about your own creative endeavor or something that he might be interested in learning more about, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Well, I got a website, oldastoria.com.
Okay, easy to remember.
Yeah. You can go there. You can see about the underground. There's stories there about the clowns, some Astoria pictures. Yeah, it's just kind of a little historical spot we have going there.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us today.
It was my fun. Just keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is the section of the show where I share my student perspective on the story Jeff had to share with us today. Jeff's story communicated one important ideal to me today, and that is that ambition drives success. He reminded me that no dream is too big to chase and no goal is out of reach as long as you just go for it. I'd like to take this time to personally thank you for listening and to say that we're incredibly proud to share this moment with you.